but it was very slow, and I could predict exactly what would happen. He would straighten his arm while the glass was moving and bring the right-hand Colt within 3 feet of my head. Even if I got the Beretta out real fast, he would still have a hell of a jump on me. The odds were not good, not good at all. "Stay alive," Leon Garber used to say. "Stay alive and see what the next minute brings." Pauly dictated the next minute.
"Put it in park," he yelled.
I heard him clearly, even through the thick glass. I moved the gear shift into park.
"Right hand where I can see it."
I put my right palm up against the window, fingers extended, just like when I signaled, "I see five people," to Duke.
"Open the door with your left."
I scrabbled blindly with my left hand and pulled the door release, pushed on the glass with my right. The door swung open. Cold air came in. I felt it around my knees.
"Both hands where I can see them," he said.
He spoke quieter, now the glass wasn't between us. He brought the left-hand Colt around on me, now the car was out of gear. I looked at the twin muzzles. It was like sitting on the foredeck of a battleship looking up at a pair of naval guns. I put both hands where he could see them.
"Feet out of the car."
I swiveled on my butt, slowly on the leather, got my feet out onto the blacktop. I felt like Terry Villanueva outside the college gate, early in the morning of day 11.
"Stand up. Step away from the car."
I levered myself upright, stepped away from the car. He pointed both guns directly at my chest. He was 4 feet away from me.
"Stand very still."
I stood very still.
"Richard!"
Richard Beck came out of the gatehouse door. He was pale. I saw Elizabeth Beck behind him in the shadows. Her blouse was open at the front. She was clutching it tight around herself. Pauly grinned at me, a sudden lunatic grin. But the guns didn't waver, not even a fraction. They stayed rock steady.
"You came back a little too soon. I was about to make him have sex with his mother."
"Are you out of your mind?" I said. "What the hell is going on?"
"I got a call. That's what's going on."
I should have been back an hour and 20 minutes ago, I thought. "Beck called you?"
"Not Beck. My boss."
"Xavier?"
"Mr. Xavier."
He stared at me like a challenge. The guns didn't move. "I went shopping," I said. "Stay alive. See what the next minute brings."
"I don't care what you did."
"I couldn't find what I wanted. That's why I'm late."
"We expected you to be late."
"Why?"
"We got new information."
I said nothing to that.
"Walk backward, to the gate."
He kept both guns 4 feet from my chest and walked forward while I walked backward through the gate. He matched me pace for pace. I stopped 20 feet inside in the middle of the driveway. He stepped to one side and half turned so he could cover me on his left and Richard and Elizabeth on his right.
"Richard! Close the gate."
He kept the left-hand Colt aimed at me and swung the right-hand Colt toward Richard. Richard saw it coming around at him and stepped up and grabbed the gate and pushed it shut. It clanged into place, loud and metallic.
"Chain it."
Richard fumbled with the chain. I heard it ringing and rattling against the iron. I heard the Cadillac idling quietly and obediently 40 feet away on the wrong side of the gate. I heard the waves pounding on the shore behind me, slow and regular and distant. I saw Elizabeth Beck in the gatehouse doorway. She was 10 feet away from the big machine gun hanging on its chain. It had no safety catch, but Pauly was in the blind spot. The back window couldn't see him.
"Lock it."
Richard snapped the padlock shut.
"Now you and your mom go stand behind Reacher."
They met near the gatehouse door, walked toward me, passed right by me. They were both white and trembling. Richard's hair was blowing. I saw his scar. Elizabeth had her arms crossed tight against her chest. I heard them both stop behind me, heard their shoes on the blacktop as they shuffled around to face my back. Pauly stepped over to the center of the driveway. He was 10 feet away. Both barrels were aimed at my chest, one to the left side, one to the right. Jacketed 44 magnums would go straight through me, and probably straight through Richard and Elizabeth, too. They might make it all the way to the house. Might break a couple of first-floor windows.
"Now Reacher holds his arms out by his sides."
I held them out, away from my body, stiff and straight, angled down.
Now, Richard takes Reacher's coat off. He pulls it down from the collar.
I felt Richard's hands on my neck. They were cold. They grasped my collar and peeled the coat down. It slid off my shoulders and came down my arms. It pulled past one wrist, then past the other.
"Ball it up!"
I heard Richard balling it up.
"Bring it here."
Richard came out from behind me carrying the balled coat. He got within 5 feet of Paulie and stopped.
"Throw it over the gate. Real far."
Richard threw it over the gate. Real far. The arms flapped in the air, and it sailed up and then down, and I heard the dull, padded thump of the Beretta in the pocket landing hard on the Cadillac's hood.
"Same thing with the jacket," Paulie said.
My jacket landed next to the coat on the Cadillac's hood and slid down the shiny paint and ended up on the road in a crumpled heap. I was cold. The wind was blowing and my shirt was thin. I could hear Elizabeth breathing behind me, fast and shallow. Richard was just standing there, 5 feet from Paulie, waiting for his next instruction.
"Now you and your mom walk 50 paces, Paulie said to him. "Back toward the house."
Richard turned and walked back and passed by me again. I heard his mother get in step with him, heard them walk away together. I turned my head and saw them stop about 40 yards back and turn around and face front again. Paulie tracked backward toward the gate, one pace, two, three. He stopped 5 feet from it. His back was to it. He had me 15 feet in front of him, and I guessed he could see Richard and Elizabeth over my shoulder, maybe 100 feet farther on in the distance. We were all in a perfect straight line on the driveway. Paulie near the gate and facing the house, Richard and Elizabeth halfway to the house and facing back at him, me in the middle, trying to stay alive to see what the next minute would bring, facing Paulie, looking him square in the eye. He smiled.
"Okay. Now, watch carefully."
He stayed facing me the whole time. He maintained eye contact. He crouched down and placed both guns on the blacktop by his feet and flipped them backward toward the base of the gate. I heard their steel frames scraping on the rough surface, saw them come to rest a yard behind him, saw his hands come back, empty. He stood up again and showed me his palms.
"No guns. I'm going to beat you to death."
Chapter 12. I could still hear the Cadillac. I could hear its lumpy V8 whisper and the faint liquid burble from its tailpipes. I could hear drive belts turning slowly under the hood. I could hear the muffler ticking as it adjusted to a new temperature.
"Rules,"
Paulie called.
"You get past me, you get the guns."
I said nothing.
"You get to them, you can use them."
I said nothing. He kept smiling.
"You understand?"
I nodded, watched his eyes.
"Okay. I won't touch the guns unless you run away. You do that, I'll pick them up and shoot you in the back. Hey, that's fair, right? You gotta stand and fight now."
I said nothing.
"Like a man."
Still I said nothing. I was cold. No coat, no jacket.
"Like an officer and a gentleman."
I watched his eyes.
"We clear on the rules?"
I said nothing. The wind was on my back.
"We clear on the rules?"
Crystal.
"He gonna run?"
I said nothing.
"I think you will, because you're a pussy."
I didn't react.
"Officer pussy. Rear echelon whore. Coward."
I just stood there. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And I doubted he knew any words I hadn't heard 100,000 times before. Military cops are never very popular. I tuned his voice out, watched his eyes and his hands and his feet instead, thought hard. I knew a lot about him. None of it was good. He was big, and he was crazy, and he was fast.
"Damn ATF spy!"
Not exactly, I thought.
"Here I come."
He didn't move. I didn't either. I just stood my ground. He was full of meth and steroids. His eyes were blazing.
coming to get you.
He didn't move. He was heavy. Heavy and strong. Very strong. If he hit me, I would go down. And if I went down, I would never get up again. I watched him. He came up on the balls of his feet. Moved. Fast. Feinted left and stopped. I stood still. Held my ground. Watched him. Thought hard. He was heavier than nature intended. Maybe by 100 or 150 pounds. Maybe by more. So he was fast. But he wouldn't be fast forever. I took a breath.
Elizabeth tells me you can't get it up.
He stared in at me. I could still hear the Cadillac. I could still hear the waves. They were crashing in way behind the house.
Big guy, but not big everywhere.
No reaction.
I bet my left-hand pinky is bigger.
I held it out, halfway curled into my palm.
And stiffer.
His face darkened. He seemed to swell up.
He exploded at me. Just launched himself forward with his right arm scything around in a giant roundhouse strike. I sidestepped his body and ducked under his arm and bounced up again and spun around. He stopped short on stiff legs and whipped back toward me. We had changed places. Now I was nearer the guns than he was.
He panicked and came at me again, same move. His right arm swung. I sidestepped and ducked, and we were back where we started, but he was breathing a little heavier than I was.
You're a big girl's blouse, I said.
It was a term of abuse I had picked up somewhere. England, maybe. I had no idea what it meant, but it worked real well with a certain type of guy. It worked real well with Paulie. He came at me again, no hesitation, same exact move. This time I crashed an elbow into his side as I spun under his arm. He bounced straight off of locked knees and came right back at me. I dodged away again and felt the breeze as his giant fist passed an inch above my head. He stood there, panting. I was warming up nicely. I was beginning to feel I had some kind of a chance. He was a very poor fighter. Lots of very big guys are. Either their sheer size is so intimidating it stops fights from ever starting in the first place, or else it lets them win every one directly after their first punch lands. Either way, they don't get much practice, they don't develop much finesse, and they get out of shape. Weights machines and treadmills are no substitute for the kind of urgent, anxious, breathless, tight-throat, high-speed, high-adrenaline fitness you need to fight on the street. I figured Paulie was a prime example. I figured he had weightlifted himself right out of the frame. I blew him a kiss.
He swarmed through the air at me, came on like a pile driver. I dodged left and put an elbow in his face, and he connected with his left hand and knocked me sideways like I weighed nothing at all. I went down on one knee and got back up just in time to arch around his next crazy lunge. His fist missed my gut by a quarter inch, and its wild momentum pulled him past me and downward a little, which put the side of his head right in line for a left hook. I let it go with everything I had from my toes on up. My fist crashed into his ear, and he staggered back, and I followed up with a colossal right to his jaw. Then I danced back and took a breather and tried to see what damage I had done. No damage. I had hit him 4 times, and it was like I hadn't hit him at all. The 2 elbows had been solid smashes, and the 2 punches had been as hard as anything I had ever thrown in my life. There was blood on his upper lip from the 2nd elbow, but there was absolutely nothing else wrong with him. Theoretically, he should have been unconscious, or in a coma. It was probably 30 years since I ever had to hit a guy more than 4 times, but he showed no pain, no concern. He wasn't unconscious. He wasn't in a coma. He was dancing around and smiling again. He was relaxed, moving easy, huge, impregnable. There was no way to hurt him. I looked at him and knew for sure I had no chance at all. And he looked at me and knew exactly what I was thinking. He smiled wider, got balanced on the balls of both feet, and hunched his shoulders down low and held his hands out in front of him like claws. He stamped his feet left, right, left, right. It was like he was pawing the ground, like he was going to come and get me and tear me apart. The smile distorted into a terrible wide grin of pleasure. He came
straight at me, and I dodged left. But he was ready for that maneuver, and he landed a right hook in the center of my chest. It felt exactly like being hit by a 400-pound weightlifter moving at 6 miles an hour. My sternum seemed to crack, and I thought my heart would stop from the shock. I came up off my feet and went down on my back. Then it was about choosing to live or choosing to die. I chose to live, rolled over twice and pushed with my hands and levered myself upright, jumped back and sideways and dodged a straight drive that would have killed me. After that, it was about staying alive and seeing what the next half second would bring. My chest hurt badly, and my mobility was below 100%, but I dodged whatever he threw for about a minute. He was fast, but he wasn't talented. I got an elbow in his face. It cracked his nose. It should have punched it out the back of his head, but at least it started bleeding. He opened his mouth to breathe. I dodged and danced and waited. Caught a huge roundhouse punch on the left shoulder that nearly paralyzed my arm. Then he near missed with a right, and for a fraction of a split second, his stance was wide open. His mouth was open because of the blood in his nose. I wound up and let go with a cigarette punch. It's a bar fight trick I learned long ago. You offer your guy a cigarette, and he takes it and lifts it to his lips and opens his mouth maybe 3/4 of an inch. Whereupon you time it just right and land a huge uppercut under his chin. It slams his mouth shut and breaks his jaw and busts his teeth, and maybe he bites his tongue off. Thank you and good night. I didn't need to offer Paulie a cigarette, because his mouth was already hanging open, so I just let go with the uppercut, gave it everything I had. It was a perfect blow. I was still thinking and still steady on my feet, and though I was small compared with him, I'm really a very big guy with a lot of training and experience. I landed the punch right where his jaw narrowed under his chin, solid bone-to-bone contact. I came up on my toes and followed through a whole yard. It should have broken his neck as well as his jaw. His head should have come right off and rolled away in the dirt, but the blow did nothing at all, absolutely nothing. Just rocked him back an inch. He shook his head once and hit me in the face. I saw it coming and did all the right things. I whipped my head back and opened my mouth wide so I wouldn't lose teeth from both parts of my jaw. Because my head was moving backward, I took some momentum out of the blow, but it was still a tremendous impact, like being hit by a train, like a car wreck. My lights went out, and I went down hard and lost track of where I was, so the blacktop came up at me like a second huge punch in the back. Air thumped out of my lungs, and I saw a spray of blood from my mouth. The back of my skull hit the driveway. The sky dimmed above me. I tried to move, but it was like a car that doesn't start with the first turn of the key. Click. Nothing. I lost half a second. My left arm was weak, so I used my right. Got halfway off the floor, folded my feet under me, and heaved myself upright. I was dizzy. I was all over the place. But Paulie was just standing still and watching me and smiling. I realized he was going to take his time with me. I realized he was going to really enjoy himself. I looked for the guns. They were still behind him. I couldn't get to them. I had hit him 6 times, and he was laughing at me. He had hit me 3 times, and I was a mess. I was badly shaken up. I was going to die. I knew it with sudden clarity. I was going to die in Abbott, Maine, on a dull Saturday morning in late April. And half of me was saying, hey, we've all got to die. What does it matter exactly where or when? But the other half was blazing with the kind of fury and arrogance that has powered so much of my life. You're going to let this particular guy take you down? I followed the silent argument intently and made my choice and spat blood and breathed hard and shaped up one last time. My mouth hurt. My head hurt. My shoulder hurt. My chest hurt. I was sick and dizzy. I spat again, traced my teeth with my tongue. It made me feel like I was smiling. So, look on the bright side. I had no fatal injuries. Yet. I hadn't been shot. So I smiled for real, and spat for the 3rd time, and said to myself, "Okay, let's die fighting." Paulie was still smiling, too. He had blood on his face, but other than that, he looked completely normal. His tie was still neat. He still had his suit coat on. He still looked like he had basketballs stuffed up into the shoulders. He watched me shape up, and he smiled wider and got down into the crouch again and did the claw hands thing again and started pawing the ground again. I figured I could dodge one more time, maybe twice, maybe three times if I was really lucky, and then it would be all over, dead in Maine on an April Saturday. I pictured Dominique Cole in my mind, and I said, "I tried, Dom. I really did." I faced front. I saw Paulie take a breath. Then I saw him move. He turned away, walked 10 feet, turned back. Then he came straight at me, fast. I dodged away. His coat slapped at me as he went past. In the corner of my eye, I saw Richard and Elizabeth far in the distance, watching. Their mouths were open like they were saying, "Those who are about to die, we salute you." Paulie switched direction fast and came toward me at a dead run. But then he got fancy, and I saw I was going to win after all. He tried to kick me, martial arts style, which is about the stupidest thing you can do in a face-to-face street fight. As soon as you have one foot off the floor, you're off balance, and you're vulnerable. You're just begging to lose. He came at me fast, with his body turned sideways like some kung fu idiot on the television. His foot was way up in the air, and he led with it, heel first, with his giant shoe held parallel with the ground. If he had connected, he would have killed me, no question. But he didn't connect. I rocked backward and caught his foot in both hands and just heaved it upward. "Can I bench press 400 pounds? Well, let's find out, asshole." I put every ounce of my strength into it and jerked him right off the ground and got his foot way up in the air, and then I dropped him on his head. He sprawled in a stunned heap with his face turned toward me. The first rule of street fighting is when you get your guy on the ground, you finish him. No hesitation, no pause, no inhibition, no gentlemanly conduct. You finish him. Paulie had ignored that rule. I didn't. I kicked him as hard as I could in the face. Blood spurted, and he rolled away from me, and I stamped on his right hand with my heel and shattered all the carpals and metacarpals and phalanges that he had in there. Then I did it again, 250 pounds of dead weight stamping down on broken bones. Then I stamped again and busted his wrist, then his forearm. He was superhuman. He rolled away and pushed himself upright with his left hand. He got on his feet and stepped away. I danced in, and he swung a huge left hook, and I knocked it aside and landed a short left on his broken nose. He rocked back, and I kneed him in the groin. His head snapped forward, and I hit him with the cigarette punch again, right-handed. His head snapped back, and I put my left elbow in his throat, stamped on his instep once, twice, and then stabbed my thumbs in his eyes. He wheeled away, and I kicked his right knee from behind, and his leg folded up, and he went down again. I got my left foot on his left wrist. His right arm was completely useless. It was just flopping around. He was pinned, unless he could backhand 250 pounds vertically with his left arm alone. And he couldn't. I guess steroids only got you so far. So I stamped on his left hand with my right foot until I could see the shattered bones coming out through the skin. Then I spun and jumped and landed square on his solar plexus, stepped off him and kicked him hard in the top of his head once, twice, three times. Then again, a fourth time. So hard my shoe fell apart and the email device came out and skittered away across the blacktop. It landed exactly where Elizabeth Beck's pager had landed when I had thrown it from the Cadillac. Paulie followed it with his eyes and stared at it. I kicked him in the head again. He sat up, just levered himself upright with the strength in his massive abs. Both arms hung uselessly by his sides. I grabbed his left wrist and turned his elbow inside out until the joint dislocated and then broke. He flapped his broken right wrist at me and slapped me with his bloody hand. I grabbed it in my left and squeezed the broken knuckles, just stared into his eyes and crushed the shattered bones. He didn't make a sound. I kept hold of his slimy hand and turned his right elbow inside out and fell on it with my knees and heard it break. Then I wiped my palms on his hair and walked away, made it to the gate, and picked up the Colts. He stood up. It was a clumsy move. His arms were useless. He slid his feet in toward his butt and jerked his weight forward onto them and levered himself upright. His nose was crushed and pouring with blood. His eyes were red and angry. "Walk," I said. I was out of breath. "To the rocks." He stood there like a stunned ox. There was blood in my mouth, loose teeth. I felt no satisfaction. None at all. I hadn't beaten him. He had beaten himself with the kung fu nonsense. If he had come at me swinging, I would have been dead inside a minute. And we both knew it. "Walk," I said, "or I'll shoot you." His chin came up like a question. "You're going in the water," I said. He just stood there. I didn't want to shoot him. I didn't want to have to move a 400-pound carcass 100 yards to the sea. He stood still, and my mind started working on the problem. Maybe I could wrap the gate chain around his ankles. Did Cadillacs have tow hooks? I wasn't sure. "Walk," I said again. I saw Richard and Elizabeth coming toward me. They were looping around in a wide circle. They wanted to get behind me without coming too close to Paulie. It was like he was a mythic figure, like he was capable of anything. I knew how they felt. He had 2 broken arms, but I was watching him like my life depended on it, which it did. If he ran at me and knocked me over, he could crush me to death with his knees. I began to doubt that the Colts would do anything to him. I imagined him swarming at me and emptying 12 bullets into him and watching them hit without slowing him down at all. "Walk," I said. He walked. He turned away and started up the driveway. I followed, 10 paces behind. Richard and Elizabeth moved farther onto the grass. We passed them, and they fell in behind me. At first, I thought of telling them to stay where they were, but then I figured they had earned the right to watch, each in their own separate ways. He followed the carriage circle around. He seemed to know where I wanted him, and he didn't seem to care. He passed by the garage block and headed behind the house and out onto the rocks. I followed, 10 paces back. I was limping because the heel had come off my right shoe. The wind was in my face. The sea was loud around us. It was rough and raging. He walked all the way to the head of Harley's Cleft. He stopped there and stood still and then turned back to face me.
"I can't swim," he said.
He slurred his words. I had broken some of his teeth and hit him hard in the throat. The wind howled around him. It lifted his hair and added another inch to his height. Spray blew past him, right at me. "No swimming involved," I replied. I shot him 12 times in the chest. All 12 bullets passed straight through him. Big chunks of flesh and muscle followed them out over the ocean. 1 guy, 2 guns, 12 loud explosions, $11.40 in ammunition. He went down backward into the water. Made a hell of a splash. The sea was rough, but the tide was wrong. It wasn't pulling. He just settled in the roiling water and floated. The ocean turned pink around him. He floated, static. Then he started drifting. He drifted out, very slowly, bucking up and down violently on the swell. He floated for a whole minute, then 2. He drifted 10 feet, then 20. He rolled over on his front with a loud sucking sound and pinwheeled slowly in the current, then faster. He was trapped just underneath the surface of the water. His jacket was soaked, and air was ballooned under it and leaking out of 12 separate bullet holes. The ocean was tossing him up and down like he weighed nothing at all. I put both empty guns on the rocks and squatted down and threw up into the ocean. Stayed down, breathing hard, watching him float, watching him spin, watching him drift away. Richard and Elizabeth kept themselves 20 feet from me. I cupped my hand and rinsed my face with cold salt water. Closed my eyes. Kept them closed for a long, long time. When I opened them again, I looked out over the rough surface of the sea and saw that he wasn't there anymore. He had finally gone under. I stayed down, breathed out, checked my watch. It was only 11 o'clock. I watched the ocean for a spell. It rose and fell. Waves broke and spray showered me. I saw the Arctic tern again. It was back, looking for a place to nest. My mind was blank. Then I started thinking, started scoping things out, started assessing the changed circumstances. I thought for 5 whole minutes and eventually got around to feeling pretty optimistic. With Paulie gone so early, I figured the end game had just gotten a whole lot faster and easier. I was wrong about that, too. The first thing that went wrong was that Elizabeth Beck wouldn't leave. I told her to take Richard and the Cadillac and get the hell out, but she wouldn't go. She just stood there on the rocks with her hair streaming and her clothes flapping in the wind. "This is my home. Pretty soon it's going to be a war zone. I'm staying. I can't let you stay. I'm not leaving. Not without my husband." I didn't know what to tell her. I just stood there, getting colder. Richard came up behind me and circled around and looked out at the sea and then back at me.
"That was cool. You beat him."
"No, he beat himself." There were noisy seagulls in the air. They were fighting the wind, circling a spot in the ocean maybe 40 yards away. They were dipping down and pecking at the crests of the waves. They were eating floating fragments of Paulie. Richard was watching them with blank eyes. "Talk to your mother. You need to convince her to get away."
"I'm not leaving." "Me either," Richard said. "This is where we live. We're a family."
They were in some kind of shock. I couldn't argue with them, so I tried to put them to work instead. We walked up the driveway, slow and quiet. The wind tore at our clothes. I was limping because of my shoe. I stopped where the bloodstains started and retrieved the email device. It was broken. The plastic screen was cracked, and it wouldn't turn on. I dropped it in my pocket. Then I found the heel rubber and sat cross-legged on the ground and put it back in place. Walking was easier after that. We reached the gate and unchained it and opened it, and I got my jacket and my coat back and put them on. I buttoned the coat and turned the collar up. Then I drove the Cadillac in through the gate and parked it near the gatehouse door. Richard chained the gate again. I went inside and opened the big Russian machine gun's breech and freed the ammunition belt. Then I lifted the gun off its chain, carried it outside into the wind, and put it sideways across the Cadillac's rear seat. I went back in and rolled the belt back into its box and took the chain off its ceiling hook and unscrewed the hook from the joist, carried the box and the chain and the hook outside and put them in the Cadillac's trunk.
"Can I help with anything?"
Elizabeth asked. "There are 20 more ammunition boxes," I said. "I want them all."
"I'm not going in there. Never again."
"Then I guess you can't help with anything." I carried 2 boxes at a time, so it took me 10 trips. I was still cold, and I was aching all over. I could still taste blood in my mouth. I stacked the boxes in the trunk and all over the floor in back and in the front passenger footwell. Then I slid into the driver's seat and tilted the mirror. My lips were split, and my gums were rimed with blood. My front teeth at the top were loose. I was upset about that. They had always been misaligned, and they had been a little chipped for years. But I got them when I was 8, and I was used to them, and they were the only ones I had.
"Are you okay?"
Elizabeth asked. I felt the back of my head. There was a tender spot where I had hit the driveway. There was a serious bruise on the side of my left shoulder. My chest hurt, and breathing wasn't entirely painless. But overall, I was okay. I was in better shape than Paulie, which is all that mattered. I thumbed my teeth up into my gums and held them there.
"Never felt better," I said. "Your lip is all swollen."
"I'll live."
"We should celebrate."
I slid out of the car. "We should talk about getting you out of here," I said. She said nothing to that. The phone inside the gatehouse started ringing. It had an old-fashioned bell in it, low and slow and relaxing. It sounded faint and far away, muffled by the noise of the wind and the sea. It rang once, then twice. I walked around the Cadillac's hood and went inside and picked it up, said Paulie's name and waited a beat, and heard a voice I hadn't heard in 10 years.
"Did he show up yet?"
I paused.
10 minutes ago,"
I said. I kept my hand halfway over the mouthpiece and made my voice high and light.
"Is he dead yet?" 5 minutes ago."
"Okay. Stay ready. This is going to be a long day." You got that right, I thought. Then the phone clicked off, and I put it down and stepped back outside.
"Who was it?"
Elizabeth asked. "Quinn," I said. The first time I heard Quinn's voice was 10 years previously, on a cassette tape. Cole had a telephone tap going. It was unauthorized, but back then military law was a lot more generous than civilian procedure. The cassette was a clear plastic thing that showed the little spools of tape inside. Cole had a player the size of a shoebox with her, and she clicked the cassette into it and pressed a button. My office filled with Quinn's voice. He was talking to an offshore bank, making financial arrangements. He sounded relaxed. He spoke clearly and slowly with the neutral, homogenized accent you get from a lifetime in the Army. He read out account numbers and gave passwords and issued instructions concerning a total of $500,000. He wanted most of it moved to the Bahamas.
"He mails the cash,"
Cole said,
"to Grand Cayman first."
"Is that safe?" She nodded.
"Safe enough. The only risk would be postal workers stealing it. But the destination address is a P.O. box, and he sends it book rate, and nobody steals books out of the mail. So he gets away with it."
$500,000 is a lot of money."
"It's a valuable weapon."
"Is it? That valuable?"
"Don't you think so?"
I shrugged. "Seems like a lot to me. For a lawn dart?" She pointed at the tape player, pointed at Quinn's voice filling the air.
"Well, that's what they're paying, obviously. I mean, how else did he get $500,000? He didn't save it out of his salary, that's for sure."
"When will you make your move?"
"Tomorrow. We'll have to. He's got the final blueprint. Gorowski says it's the key to the whole thing."
"How will it go down?"
"Fresconi is dealing with the Syrian. He's going to mark the cash with a judge advocate watching. Then we'll all observe the exchange. We'll open the briefcase that Quinn gives to the Syrian immediately in front of the same judge. We'll document the contents, which will be the key blueprint. Then we'll go pick Quinn up. We'll arrest him and impound the briefcase that the Syrian gave to him. The judge can watch us open it later. We'll find the marked cash inside, and therefore we'll have a witnessed and documented transaction, and therefore Quinn will go down and he'll stay down."
"Watertight," I said. "Good work."
"Thank you."
"Will Fresconi be okay?"
"He'll have to be. I can't deal with the Syrian myself. Those guys are weird with women. They can't touch us, can't look at us. Sometimes they can't even talk to us. So Fresconi will have to do it."
"Want me to hold his hand?"
"His part is all off stage. There's nothing much he can screw up."
"I think I'll hold his hand anyway."
"Thank you."
"And he'll go with you to make the arrest?" She said nothing. "I can't send you one-on-one, you know that." She nodded. "But I'll tell him you're the lead investigator. I'll make sure he understands it's your case."
"Okay."
She pressed the stop button on her tape player. Quinn's voice died halfway through a word. The word was going to be dollars, as in 200,000, but it came out as da. He sounded bright and happy and alert, like a guy at the top of his game, fully aware he was busy playing and winning. Cole ejected the cassette, slipped it into her pocket. Then she winked at me and walked out of my office.
"Who's Quinn?"
Elizabeth Beck asked me 10 years later. "Frank Xavier," I said. "He used to be called Quinn. His full name is Francis Xavier Quinn."
"You know him?"
"Why else would I be here?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm a guy who knew Frank Xavier back when he was called Francis Xavier Quinn."
"You work for the government."
I shook my head. "This is strictly personal."
"What will happen to my husband?"
"No idea. And I don't really care either way." I went back inside Paulie's little house and locked the front door. Came out again and locked the back door behind me. Then I checked the chain on the gate. It was tight. I figured we could keep intruders out for a minute, maybe a minute and a half, which might be good enough. I put the padlock key in my pants pocket. "Back to the big house now. You'll have to walk, I'm afraid." I drove the Cadillac down the driveway with the ammunition boxes stacked behind and beside me. I saw Elizabeth and Richard in the mirror, hurrying side by side. They didn't want to get out of town, but they weren't too keen on being left alone. I stopped the car by the front door and backed it up, ready to unload. I opened the trunk and took the ceiling hook and the chain and ran upstairs to Duke's room. His window looked out along the whole length of the driveway. It would make an ideal gun port. I took the Beretta out of my coat pocket and snicked the safety off and fired it once into the ceiling. I saw Elizabeth and Richard, 50 yards away, stop dead and then start running toward the house. Maybe they thought I had shot the cook. Or myself. I stood on a chair and punched through the bullet hole and raked the plaster back until I found a wooden joist. Then I aimed carefully and fired again and drilled a neat 9mm hole in the wood. I screwed the hook into it and slipped the chain onto it and tested it with my weight. It held. I went back down and opened the Cadillac's rear doors. Elizabeth and Richard arrived, and I told them to carry the ammunition boxes. I carried the big machine gun. The metal detector on the front door squealed at it, loud and urgent. I carried it upstairs, hung it on the chain, and fed the end of the first belt into it. Swung the muzzle to the wall and opened the lower sash of the window. Swung the muzzle back and traversed it side to side and ranged it up and down. It covered the whole width of the distant wall and the whole length of the driveway down to the carriage circle. Richard stood and watched me. "Keep stacking the boxes," I said. Then I stepped over to the nightstand and picked up the outside phone, called Duffy at the motel. "You still want to help?" I asked her.
"Yes."
"Then I need all three of you at the house, quick as you can." After that, there was nothing more to be done until they arrived. I waited by the window and pressed my teeth into my gums with my thumb and watched the road. Watched Richard and Elizabeth struggling with the heavy boxes. Watched the sky. It was noon, but it was darkening. The weather was getting even worse. The wind was freshening. The North Atlantic coast in late April. Unpredictable. Elizabeth Beck came in and stacked a box, breathed hard, stood still.
"What's going to happen?"
"No way of telling."
"What's this gun for?"
"It's a precaution."
"Against what?"
"Quinn's people. We've got our backs to the sea. We might need to stop them on the driveway."
"You're going to shoot at them?"
"If necessary."
"What about my husband?"
"Do you care?"
She nodded. "Yes, I do."
"I'm going to shoot at him, too." She said nothing. "He's a criminal. He can take his chances."
"The laws that make him a criminal are unconstitutional."
"You think?"
She nodded again. "The Second Amendment is clear."
"Take it to the Supreme Court. Don't bother me with it."
"People have the right to bear arms."
"Drug dealers don't. I never saw an amendment that says it's okay to fire automatic weapons in the middle of a crowded neighborhood, using bullets that go through brick walls one after the other, and through innocent bystanders one after the other, babies and children." She said nothing. You ever seen a bullet hit a baby? It doesn't slide right in like a hypodermic needle. It crushes its way through, like a bludgeon, crushing and tearing. She said nothing. Never tell a soldier that guns are fun.
The law is clear.
So join the NRA. I'm happy right here in the real world.
He's my husband.
You said he deserved to go to prison.
Yes, but he doesn't deserve to die.
You think?
He's my husband,
she said again. How does he make the sales?
He uses I-95. He cuts the centers out of the cheap rugs and rolls the guns in them, like tubes or cylinders. Drives them to Boston or New Haven. People meet him there.
I nodded, remembered the stray carpet fibers I had seen around.
He's my husband.
I nodded again. If he's got the sense not to stand right next to Quinn, he might be okay.
Promise me he'll be okay. Then I'll leave with Richard.
I can't promise.
Then we're staying.
I said nothing.
It was never a voluntary association, you know. With Xavier, I mean. You really need to understand that.
She moved to the window and gazed down at Richard. He was heaving the last ammunition case out of the Cadillac.
There was coercion.
Yes, I figured that out.
He kidnapped my son.
I know. Then she moved again and looked straight at me.
What did he do to you?
I saw Cole twice more that day as she prepared her end of the mission. She was doing everything right. She was like a chess player. She never did anything without looking two moves ahead. She knew the judge advocate she asked to monitor the transaction would have to recuse himself from the subsequent court-martial, so she picked one she knew the prosecutors hated. It would be one less obstacle later. She had a photographer standing by to make a visual record. She had timed the drive out to Quinn's Virginia house. The file I had given her at the start now filled two cardboard boxes. The second time I saw her, she was carrying them. They were stacked one on top of the other, and her biceps were straining against their weight.
How's Gorowski holding up? I asked her.
Not good, but he'll be out of the woods tomorrow.
You're going to be famous.
I hope not. This should stay classified forever.
Famous in the classified world. Plenty of people see that stuff.
So I guess I should ask for my performance review. Day after tomorrow, maybe?
We should have dinner tonight. We should go out, like a celebration. Best place we can find, I'll buy.
I thought you were on food stamps.
I've been saving up.
You've had plenty of opportunity. It's been a long case.
Slow as molasses. That's your only problem, Cole. You're thorough, but you're slow.
She smiled again and hitched the boxes higher.
You should have agreed to date me. Then I could have shown you how slow can be better than fast.
She carried the boxes away, and I met her 2 hours later at a restaurant in town. It was an upmarket place, so I had showered and put a clean uniform on. She showed up wearing a black dress, not the same one as before, no dots on it, just sheer black. It was very flattering. Not that she needed the help. She looked about 18.
Great, I said. They're going to think you're dining with your dad.
My uncle, maybe. My dad's younger brother.
It was one of those meals where the food wasn't important. I can remember everything else about the evening, but I can't remember what I ordered. Steak, maybe. Or ravioli. Something. I know we ate. We talked a lot, about the kind of stuff we probably wouldn't share with just anybody. I came very close to breaking down and asking her if she wanted to find a motel. But I didn't. We had a glass of wine each, and then switched to water. There was an unspoken agreement we needed to stay sharp for the next day. I paid the check, and we left at midnight, separately. She was bright, even though it was late. She was full of life and energy and focus. She was bubbling with anticipation. Her eyes were shining. I stood on the street and watched her drive away.
Someone's coming.
Elizabeth Beck said, 10 years later. I glanced out the window and saw a gray Taurus far in the distance. The color blended with the rock and the weather and made it hard to see.
It was maybe 2 miles away, coming around a curve in the road, moving fast. Villanueva's car. I told Elizabeth to stay put and keep an eye on Richard, and I went downstairs and out the back door. I retrieved Angel Dahl's keys from my hidden bundle, put them in my jacket pocket. I took Duffy's Glock and her spare magazines, too. I wanted her to get them back intact. It was important to me. She was already in enough trouble. I stashed them in my coat pocket with my Beretta and walked around to the front of the house and got in the Cadillac. Drove it up to the gate and slid out and waited out of sight. The Taurus stopped outside the gate, and I saw Villanueva at the wheel with Duffy next to him and Elliot in the back. I stepped out of hiding and took the chain off the gate and swung it open. Villanueva eased through and stopped nose to nose with the Cadillac. Then three doors opened, and they all climbed out into the cold and stared at me.
"What the hell happened to you?" Villanueva said.
I touched my mouth. It felt swollen and tender. "Walked into a door," I said. Villanueva glanced at the gatehouse.
"Heh, you're a doorman. Am I right?"
"You okay?" Duffy asked.
"I'm in better shape than the doorman."
"Why are we here?"
"Plan B," I said. "We're going to Portland. But if we don't find what we need up there, we're going to have to come back here and wait. So two of you are coming out with me right now, and the other one is staying here to hold the fort." I turned around and pointed at the house. "The center, second-floor window has got a big machine gun mounted in it to cover the approach. I need one of you in there manning it." Nobody volunteered. I looked straight at Villanueva. He was old enough to have been drafted way back. He might have spent time around big machine guns. "You do it, Terry."
"Not me. I'm coming out with you to find Teresa."
He said it like there was going to be no way to argue with him.
"Okay, I'll do it,"
Elliot said. "Thanks. You ever seen a Vietnam movie? Seen the door gunner on a Huey? That's you. If they come, they won't try to get through the gate. They'll go in the front window of the gatehouse and out the back door, or the back window, so you'll be ready to hose them down as they come out."
"What if it's dark?"
"We'll be back before dark."
"Okay. Who's in the house?"
"Beck's family and the cook. They're non-combatants, but they won't leave."
"What about Beck himself?"
"He'll come back with the others. If he got away again in the confusion, it wouldn't break my heart. But if he got hit in the confusion, it wouldn't break my heart either."
"Okay."
"They probably won't show up. They're busy. This is all just a precaution."
"Okay.
You keep the Cadillac. We'll take the Taurus."
Villanueva got back in the Ford and reversed it out through the gate again. I walked out with Duffy and closed the gate from the outside and chained it and locked it and tossed the padlock key over to Elliot.
"See you later," I said.
He turned the Cadillac around and I watched him drive it down toward the house. Then I got in the Taurus with Duffy and Villanueva. She took the front seat. I took the back. I got her Glock and her spare magazines out of my pocket and passed them forward to her, like a little ceremony.
"Thanks for the loan."
She put the Glock in her shoulder holster and the magazines in her purse.
"You're very welcome."
"Teresa first," Villanueva said. "Quinn second. Okay?"
"Agreed," I said.
He K-turned on the road and took off west.
"So, where do we look?"
"Choice of three locations. There's the warehouse, there's a city center office, and there's a business park near the airport. You can't keep a prisoner in a city center office building over the weekend, and the warehouse is too busy. They just had a big shipment. So my vote goes with the business park."
I-95 or Route 1?
Route 1.
We drove in silence 15 miles inland and turned north on Route 1 toward Portland. Chapter 13. It was early afternoon on a Saturday, so the business park was quiet. It was rinsed clean by rain, and it looked fresh and new. The metal buildings glowed like dull pewter under the gray of the sky. We cruised through the network of streets at maybe 20 miles an hour. Saw nobody. Quinn's building looked locked up tight. I turned my head as we drove by and studied the sign again. Xavier Export Company. The words were professionally etched on thick stainless steel, but the oversized X's looked like an amateur's idea of graphic design.
Why does it say export? Duffy asked. He's importing stuff, surely.
How do we get in? Villanueva asked. We break in, I said. Through the rear, I guess. The buildings were laid out back to back, with neat parking lots in front of each of them. Everything else in the park was either a road or new lawn, bounded by neat, poured concrete curbs. There were no fences anywhere. The building directly behind Quinn's was labeled Paul Keast and Chris Maiden, Professional Catering Services. It was closed up and deserted. I could see past it all the way to Quinn's back door, which was a plain metal rectangle painted dull red.
Nobody around, Duffy said.
There was a window on Quinn's back wall near the red door. It was made from pebbled glass, probably a bathroom window. It had iron bars over it.
Security system? Villanueva said.
On a new place like this?
Almost certainly. Wired direct to the cops?
I doubt it. That wouldn't be smart for a guy like Quinn. He doesn't want the cops snooping around every time some kid busts his windows.
Private company?
That's my guess. Or his own people.
So, how do we do it?
We do it real fast. Get in and out before anybody reacts. We can risk 5 or 10 minutes, probably.
One at the front, and two at the back?
You got it. You take the front. I told him to pop the trunk, and then Duffy and I slid out of the car. The air was cold and damp, and the wind was blowing. I took the tire iron out from under the spare wheel and closed the trunk lid and watched the car drive away. Duffy and I walked down the side of the catering place and across the dividing lawn to Quinn's bathroom window. I put my ear against the cold metal siding and listened. Heard nothing. Then I looked at the window bars. They were made up from a shallow, one-piece rectangular iron basket that was secured by 8 machine screws, 2 on each side of the 4 sides of the rectangle. The screws went through welded flanges the size of quarters. The screw heads themselves were the size of nickels. Duffy pulled the Glock out of her shoulder holster. I heard it scrape on the leather. I checked the Beretta in my coat pocket, held the tire iron, two-handed, put my ear back on the siding. Heard Villanueva's car pull up at the front of the building. I could hear the beat of the engine coming through the metal. I heard his door open and close. He left the engine running. I heard his feet on the front walkway.
Stand by, I said.
I felt Duffy move behind me. Heard Villanueva knocking loudly on the front door. I stabbed the tire iron end-on into the siding next to one of the screws, made a shallow dent in the metal, shoved the iron sideways into it and under the bars, and hauled on it. The screw held. Clearly, it went through the siding all the way into the steel framing. So I reseated the iron and jerked harder, once, twice. The screw head broke off, and the bars moved a little. I had to break 6 screw heads in total. Took me nearly 30 seconds. Villanueva was still knocking. Nobody was answering. When the 6th screw broke, I grabbed the bars themselves and hauled them open 90 degrees like a door. The 2 remaining screws screeched in protest. I picked up the tire iron again and smashed the pebbled glass, reached in with my hand and found the catch and pulled the window open, took out the Beretta and went headfirst into the bathroom. It was a small cubicle, maybe 6 by 4. There was a toilet and a sink with a small frameless mirror, a trash can and the shelf with spare toilet rolls and paper towels on it, a bucket and a mop propped in a corner, clean linoleum on the floor, a strong smell of disinfectant. I turned around and checked the window. There was a small alarm pad screwed to the sill, but the building was still quiet. No siren, a silent alarm. Now a phone would be ringing somewhere, or an alert would be flashing on a computer screen. I stepped out of the bathroom into a back hallway. Nobody there. It was dark. I faced front and backed away to the rear door, fumbled behind me without looking, and unlocked it, pulled it open, heard Duffy step inside. She had probably done 6 weeks at Quantico during her basic training, and she still remembered the moves. She held the Glock two-handed and slid past me and took up station by a door that was going to lead out of the hallway into the rest of the building. She leaned her shoulder on the jamb and crooked her elbows to pull the gun up out of my way. I stepped forward and kicked the door and went through it and dodged left, and she spun after me and went to the right. We were in another hallway. It was narrow. It ran the whole length of the building all the way to the front. There were rooms off it, left and right. 6 rooms. 3 on either side. 6 doors. All of them closed.